hard to believe that it is October and it's already been so cold at the University of Richmond football stadium that four layers of clothing were not enough. I have a funny comment to make, but I've counseled with a couple of people and they've suggested that probably it's better not to say that particular one, but we did have some fun there at the game. I'd like to invite you to turn to Exodus chapter 7. And for those of you who've been with us for a while and get a little concerned that Exodus 7 seems like a section that we've already talked about, that's right. We're going there for just a moment to set context. And you visited in this group once before? Do I remember that? Yeah. Okay. But not, oh, okay. So not in this class. Okay. So once again, your names.
Charlotte and John Bryant.
And that Bryant has a T or a Bryant. Let's see if I can remember something for more than 30 seconds. He knows you. That's and you know him. That's amazing right there. Okay. We have been working our way through Exodus, and in chapter 7 began what we call the plagues. And I just want to very quickly remind you, these are building. And as they build, some things are happening. We've already walked through this. I want to remind you very, very quickly. The Nile River is turned to blood. The frogs come. Pharaoh is asked, let my people go, and he says no. But something to notice right there. Is that really what Moses said to Pharaoh? God says, let my people go. The answer is no. That is not what he said. That's what everybody thinks he says, and he didn't say that. He said something very, very different and very, very special. He said, God says, let my people go to worship me. And that is very consistent through this section. Most people forget that part. Early on, Pharaoh says no because his heart was hardened. He hardened his heart. He hardened his heart, one of the translations says. After a while, past the frogs are the mosquitoes. Some translations say gnats, but mosquitoes are a lot more bugging to me, not to make too much of a pun. Horse flies, the death of the Egyptians, livestock, boils and hail, and locusts and darkness. Through this time, there is about halfway through, a little over halfway through, a switch. It no longer says Pharaoh hardened his heart, it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart. There comes a point where God says, if you're on a course and you stay on it long enough, God finally says, okay, that's what you want. I'll second the motion. And so the collisions have come. In chapter 11, Moses and Pharaoh have one last meeting. This time Moses doesn't have the plague come. He tells Pharaoh ahead of time what the plague is going to be. The firstborn of Egypt is going to die. And in verse 8 of chapter 11, Moses leaves Pharaoh's presence. Verse 9, Moses was told by God, Pharaoh will not listen, and there's more that's going to happen. And we come to chapter 12. Now, your assignment has been, a few of you who haven't been here, this assignment won't be incumbent on you. But the rest of you, you've been asked in your assignment to read all the way through, or at least up to, Exodus 19. And all of you have done that, right? All of you have done that. Sure, right, Bruce? Now, here's what I want to try to make sure you noticed as you did that. Chapter 12 doesn't read like the chapters before. Chapter 12 doesn't read like the chapters after. Something different is in here. And I want to make sure today, this is going to be the focus of today, I want to make sure you realize what's different. It's almost as if someone is coming from a great distance away, from almost another time and place, and coming in and talk to the people. And here's what's happening. That person is God. And God comes to the people and says, something is about to happen to you, and you are never, ever to forget it. So, even as you are experiencing these things, I want you already preparing how you will remember this. And how not just you will remember this, but how your children and their children and their children for all of time, one translation says, will remember. The institution of this ceremony seems in this part of Exodus to be placed and woven in with the actual events. That the people are told, even as the events are coming, they aren't even here yet, they're told, this is going to happen to you, and in years to come, in another time, in another place, you need to reenact this so that you will never forget, so that your children will never forget, so that their children will never forget forever. And so I want us to look this way. What's the first thing God does? Chapter 12, verse 1, God is speaking to Moses and Aaron, and they're still in Egypt. And he begins by saying, we're going to change the calendar. Any of you work in financial settings, or any of you do your own taxes, one of the things that happens is you're forced to choose the year that you will report on. You can choose a calendar year, or you can use a fiscal year. I've always thought for academic purposes that the year should start in September, maybe August, and that it should end in July, or maybe August, because that's the rhythm of the year. Calendar years don't really work, but the start of the calendar year is in the middle of the year. If you read carefully, and I'm inviting you to read verse 1 and 2 of chapter 12, God is changing the calendar, but he's not changing the months. He's simply reordering the months. This month, the month that you're experiencing right now, that needs to be the first month of the year. And the most special day of that month is the 14th. That's the day of the month in which all these things are going to happen. So he's not moving the days. He's not saying this was the most important day and that's now going to be day one. He's saying leave everything the same, but the month in which this happened, that becomes the first of those months. For the Jewish people, that is maintained. When these days come, this is the most important time of the year. The year is sort of calculated through that. What's the most important time in the Christian calendar? Those who are followers of Christ, what's the most important time? Many people would say Christmas. But it's Easter. And the fact that it's not so clearly Easter is probably a little bit of a condemnation of how well we're remembering pivotal and major events. Final comment for what it's worth. Those two dates are usually very close together, and the two events are very parallel. What Passover means for the Jewish people, Easter means for Christian people, and the parallels are very, very strong. I want to encourage you to begin to see some of those here. So it starts out with a new calendar. The second thing, starting in verse 3 and running through verse 14, is a new celebration, a new ceremony. That ceremony is picked up and commented on quite a bit further than verse 14, but this is the first place it's really talked about. In that new ceremony, there is a singular action. Let's review where we've been. There's a new calendar, there's a new ceremony, and in that ceremony is a special singular action. What's the action? The death of a lamb. You have to choose a lamb a couple of days before, prepare the lamb. The lamb is killed or slaughtered, and then certain things are done with that. That singular action, the central action, the death of the lamb. What do you do with the lamb after it's dead? You do two things. Part of it you do with its blood. Part of it you do with its body. What do you do with its blood? You paint it onto the doorposts or the lintels. I'm not a construction engineer, but I think the lintels go this way and the doorposts go this way. You're supposed to paint it there. And what do you do with the body? There's even instructions for how to cook. You don't have lamb sushi. You don't eat it raw. You don't boil it. You roast it. And you roast it intact. You take out the entrails, but other than that, you roast it intact. Roasting intact is what you do when you don't have much time. And that's one of the underlying themes that goes with this. Everything you do, you will be doing it in haste. So in your rituals, in your ceremonies of remembrance, as you reenact this, you reenact as if you're doing things in haste. And down around verse 25, when you have entered the country which the Lord will give you as he promised, every time it mentions the country that you're going to be given, it adds, as God promised, as God promised, as God promised. You'll see that drumbeat all the way through here. You will observe this ritual, verse 26, and when your children ask, what does this ritual mean, here's what you say. That's actually repeated a couple of times in chapter 13 or chapter 14. There's another one of these. If you take a look at chapter 13, verse 14, when one of your sons asks you in days to come, what does this mean? Here's what you're to say. Chapter 12, chapter 13 almost seem not to fit, because up till now it's been as if a historian was recording the events as they happened and this sort of thing. And then suddenly it's as if you take a step back and somebody from another place and time, that's God who's outside of place and time and in control of all of place and time, steps in and says, as you experience this, begin to build into your experience the preparation for a ritual of remembrance. You have a special meal, and it's cooked a special way. Look at verse 10 and verse 11. When you eat the meal in a special way. And that's the way my verse 10 starts out. Verse 11. This is how you must eat it. And I'm assuming there it says fork or knife, that it says hold it in your right hand or your left hand, eat small portions that are cut up, or take one big chunk and chew on it a while. And it's not saying anything like that. What does it say? This is how you must eat it. Read that next little bit. That's verse 11, chapter 13. What does it say? It starts talking about your clothes. What's going on? What's he saying? You eat as if that's the last meal you will ever have in that place. And that as soon as the meal is over, you're on your feet and leaving that place forever to go to some different place to be there for the rest of your life. That sense of there's not much time, you're rushing, and a journey is ahead of you is the context. Remember, all this God is saying to Moses, this is how you will do this in the distant future when all this is over and you're in a new place and a new time, so that you don't forget what happened here. How many times have you had something happen to you that only in looking back you can realize its significance and its importance? At the moment, it just seems like one more thing. I'm thinking of two things this morning. One of these is that a long time ago, I finished college and went to graduate school. And I don't want you to hear this as bragging. I want you to hear this rather as setting a stage for something important. When I went to graduate school, I was given an NSF fellowship, a National Science Foundation fellowship. Those turn out not to be given to just everybody, and why they gave one to me, I still don't know, but they did. And coming with that were certain perks, certain advantages. The big, huge advantage was that having such a fellowship gave you a source of resources, of money to live on, money to do work with, that essentially eliminated all the distractions that otherwise might fall to graduate students. In specific, I didn't have to teach. Most graduate students have to do some kind of teaching in order to earn some kind of a living that lets them stay in graduate school and do that long time. The alternative is massive debt. In my case, the fellowship paid all my tuition and fees, gave me money to live on, gave me stuff to do my research with. All those distractions were taken away. And the first day that I was on the campus of the University of Florida, I went into the chair, to the office of the chair of the department, and I said, by the way, I'd like to teach. And I don't think I heard the sound of his jaw hitting the desk, but his jaw dropped. This was unthinkable. No graduate student teaches voluntarily. Graduate students teach because they have to. That's the price for doing what they're there to do. And he tried to talk me out of it. Tried real hard. My brother was 2 years ahead of me at Florida in chemistry. That's another story. But he and his friends were there. They became the first friends I had. And I mentioned to them what I was doing. And I think the mildest comment, the one that didn't come with profanity and other things, were, "You are out of your mind. What are you doing?" Florida had a wonderful teacher, a guy by the name of John Baxter. He's one of the best chemistry teachers in the United States. He had been on NBC teaching chemistry in the early morning courses that NBC used to run back when they had really, really good early morning programming. I had the chance to learn from this guy, and I wanted to do that. I did not want to miss that opportunity. Everybody around me said, "You're nuts." I just saw it as, I've got this opportunity to do something, I want to do that. It turns out that almost everything else important that's happened in my life happened because of that decision on that day. Almost everything that happened, happened because of that. The job I got at Richmond was in part because of that decision that morning. The repercussions of that have echoed through the whole of my life. I didn't see it as, "Oh, I am changing the direction of my life." I saw it as, "This is what I need to do." Most of the time, that's the way we are. God says, "This one is so important. I want you to spot it for what it is the day it happens. And be prepared that day to teach your children, to teach their children, to teach their children forever." And that worked. Jewish people today, this is still the central part of their remembrance as Jewish people of what God has done for them. The second one, I'll try to be brief. There's a church in Nashville that has a monthly messenger kind of thing. I think ours is called The Spirit. I forget what theirs is called. There's an article in there this month, and it's about a young couple in their church that's going to be married in December. We plan to be there for that wedding. It's my brother's younger son. He's a physician, and he was trained in Memphis, had come to Nashville as a new physician, and one of the first things he did when he got there, he had been on mission trips and all that, he was looking around for some group to become part of, and before he became part of a church, he got involved with a group that was getting ready to go to Haiti to do medical missionaries. He had gone as a medical student, he was ready to go as a physician. And it turned out the day they were supposed to land in Haiti was the day before. The day before that day was the earthquake, so they couldn't go. And they had to wait. I think it took them 3 or 4 months before they got there. So here he is, cooling his heels, waiting on going. Meantime, there's a young woman who's a pharmacist in Nashville. She's getting ready to go in October to Haiti. And 2 days before she goes, she said it later, "I don't understand what's wrong with me. I am always so organized." She had forgotten to renew her passport. 2 days before the trip, she realizes she can't go. She doesn't have a passport. She can't even go the next time the group is getting ready to go without expedited help. And so she talks to her then boyfriend and says, "What do you think I should do?" Because her options are fly to New Orleans or miss the trip. He said, "I think you should fly to New Orleans and get your passport renewed." So she flies to New Orleans, gets her passport. She then heads into Haiti about 5 months after she meant to, lands at the airport at the same time as my nephew, and the two groups end up in the same hotel working in parallel across the city. They spend every night in big groups talking with each other, and they notice each other. And all of that has now developed to when they're ready to get married. Neither of them realized that the things that took them into Haiti were also taking them into something that would change the rest of their lives. But that one they will remember and they will celebrate. On and some of that's being recorded. That's what's happening here, and you need to understand that. When you read through this, it is not, "Oh, this happened and this." It's not the setting of the historian. It's the setting of, "I am preparing you for a forever of remembering this." So, what is Passover? Passover. Who passed, and what did they pass over? Who passed? The angel of death. When you read in this section, it will say the Lord came. And then a little bit later, and I think I can show you where this is, it's verse 23, right at the end of verse 23. My translation says the destroyer. There's at least one other translation that says the death angel. It doesn't say the angel of death, it says the death angel. What did the death angel, or what did the destroyer pass over? The houses that had the blood of the Lamb painted on the door of the lintel. where did the death angel not pass over? The houses of all the Egyptians, including the livestock. There's an old song, and I thought about it a little while ago as I listened to Paul's comments about a prayer request up here. The chorus goes, glory to his name, glory to his name. Remember the third line? There to my heart was the blood applied, glory to his name. That old hymn starts, down at the cross where my Savior died, down where for cleansing from sin I cried, there to my heart was the blood applied, glory to his name. That phrase, there to my heart was the blood applied, is almost the same phrase as what you're hearing here. The blood of the Lamb goes on the door, and the death angel passes by, passes over. Now, I want you to take a careful look at verse 14, because there's a very odd word in verse 14. This involves death. It involves grief. It involves narrow escape. Let me explain the narrow escape before I go any further. There is an amazing series of sentences in here, and they're so subtle, you're liable to miss them. They're so subtle, you're liable to miss them. I want you to look at verse 28. Chapter 12, verse 28. Quiet little verse. Looks like it has no significance of any sort. Chapter 12, verse 28. What does it say? The Israelites went away and obeyed. Every one of them. You want to try to get the people in this church to all do one thing and do it with less than 24 hours notice and do it in very specific ways? I don't think you got a chance. They have had nine plagues. How many people are we talking about? How many people are we talking about? Okay. 600,000 men of fighting age. A couple of million people. And they all did as the Lord commanded. Every one of them. That's a miracle right there. Yes, I'm trying to be a little funny, but that's pretty close. Verse 14. Bill, funny word,
I have a curiosity. Do we know the time frame for the first plague and when they did the blood smear?
No, we don't know how much time is in between the plagues. I have the sense that from the time Moses left Pharaoh's presence in verse 8 of chapter 11 to when all of this took place was either 24 or 48 hours. I don't think there was much more time than that.
That's just the last plague of notice.
Yeah. The others, it's not clear how long that happened. Long enough for them to have built some buildings with bricks and some archaeologists to think that they saw some that had straw, had straw, had reeds, what the people would have been able to gather on their own, and then had none. Archaeologists claim to have seen some buildings that had several courses of bricks like that, and you probably don't do that in a day or two.
This is the ninth plague of the darkness was for 3 days.
Yeah. I will tell you this. When you go back to the choosing of a lamb and preparing a lamb, they talk about choose the lamb on the 11th and prepare the lamb on the 14th. That may be a reference.
Also, male lamb with no defects.
Yes, those are details that I'm not going into all of that I could. But if you picture Jesus' death and then his resurrection, that there's this hint of 3 days that seems to show up a lot. So if you wanted to guess something, maybe 72 hours or 3 days, whatever those mean, might be something closer to it. But the idea is not much time. But that's only the last one. I think that's the only one we can say with any assurance. And even that one I think we need to be careful of. Back to verse 14, there's an odd word. When you celebrate this, what's the word they use for that celebration? They use the word feast. Does that seem an odd word to use? What's the meal? Quickly roasted lamb What else? Unleavened bread. And there's a pretty big deal made of this. It comes at 6, 7, 8 places across this 3 or 4 chapter period. They make a big deal of it. The bread didn't have time to rise. So they ended up carrying the bread in bowls on their backs as they made the run out of Egypt. And they tell you now in the future, don't use leaven. We didn't have, it's not clear to me, it's clear to some commentators, but I'm not sure they're right. I'm not sure if they used leaven and it hadn't had time, and therefore for you to celebrate this and remember this, you don't use leaven, and it will show you the same thing. But certainly the picture is you had bread that had not had time to rise or be leavened. Okay, and what was the rest of the meal? Bitter herbs. Okay. I told the first hour that I can remember very clearly in my childhood my mother trying to get me to eat spinach. The word hate or detest would probably be approaching what I felt about spinach in those days. It is amazing to me on this side of my experience base that my mother never served me spinach in a salad raw, just the leaves. I don't remember her ever feeding me or offering me spinach in a dip with chips. Okay. It turns out spinach is pretty good. And those of you who are purists and say spinach is not an herb, yes, 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 I know that. Okay. What's the symbolism of the bitter herbs? If you dig far enough, it will say, when your children ask, here is what you are to say. What are bitter herbs used for? I'm going to dare to look to my left to at least one of the physicians that's in the room. What are bitter herbs used for? There is a naturalistic product called Swedish bitter herbs. I heard about it this morning from someone who uses it. It's designed to, and I quote, cleanse the liver and the kidneys. Okay. We prayed this morning for an 11-year-old boy who's got kidney stones. Maybe you need some bitter herbs. What else is it used for? It turns out it's used in purification rites. There are times in the sacrificial system that you'll see just one or two where it says, when you do this with herbs or something. So there's a picture of the reminder of how bitter it was in Egypt. I think that's the big one. But there's also this sense of, again, part of that meal to purify maybe or to have some peace like that. But that's not the kind of meal that I would associate with a feast. Would you agree? So what's the purpose of a feast? What allows a meal to be called a feast? Is it the quality of the food? Is it the quantity of the food? It's what you're remembering or celebrating that makes it a feast, right? Unusual use of that word. And I just want to make sure you see that on the way back. And I think that's when God says, when your children ask, this is what you're to say. That's a piece of that. Chapter 12, verse 21, Moses instructed the people through their leaders. He summoned the elders and told them, go and do this. He tells them what to do. And that's still part of the ritual. Verse 26, when your children ask, why are we doing this? Now notice how powerful this is. This is when your children now ask, why are you doing this, Daddy? Why are you doing this, Mama? You've got an answer then, and that turns into something you say when you're remembering this years from now in another place, in another time. Verse 29 of chapter 12, the plague hits. The death angel comes. Who dies? If you read this, it is amazing. The firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, the heir to the throne, all the way to the firstborn of who? The lowest prisoner in the filthiest dungeon. The firstborn of Egypt dies, and the firstborn of all the livestock. What do you think happened that night? Don't have to guess. Just read another verse or two. Everybody's up. They're all wailing. And Pharaoh calls in Moses and Aaron before it's even light yet. And what does he say? Up. Get out. And if you listen carefully to what he says, it's clear that Pharaoh has heard it. Pharaoh did not hear, "Let my people go." What did Pharaoh hear? "Let my people go and worship me." Do you see how he repeats that? I'm looking at verse 31. "Go and worship the Lord as you have asked. Take your herds and your livestock too, as you have asked." And then he adds one phrase that's stunning. What's the phrase? "And bless me too." You have a sense that Pharaoh has realized it's his obstinance that has brought the death of his son and the death of all these others. You have the sense that Pharaoh is realizing that one is not necessarily the limit of all who will die. If I don't let them go now, all the rest of us could die as well. Let's get them out. Go. And it's almost like instead of letting them go, they push them out. Verses 35 and 36, the Israelites did what God instructed them to. "You want us to leave? Give us some provisions for the trip." And they plundered Egypt. Years later, when it's time to build the tabernacle, the first physical place of worship, God says to Moses, "Ask the people to make contributions. These are poor slaves with no resources. How can they make contributions?" The answer is they plundered Egypt on the way out. They have gold. They have all kinds of precious things. Not only that, you'll find out a little bit later, they have enough armor to where all 600,000 fighting men are armed. It says they were fully armed. Didn't know how to fight. They had not had a history of learning how to fight. But they were armed. So where did they go? Verse 37. Where did they go? I think I'm still in chapter 12, right? Where do they start? Ramses. This is described as one of the treasure cities, the place that they built. Remember, Joseph had built places to store the grain for the 7 good years. These were places to store the treasure. So when you ask, where did the treasure come from they walked out with, looks like they plundered the treasure city. Okay, where was this place? If you can picture more or less the Mediterranean Sea, and you've got the Nile Delta sitting here doing whatever it is, which funnels down to the Nile River Valley down here. Ramses was somewhere here, and the modern Suez Canal is kind of like that, opening up to the Red Sea. And what they've done is they've gone to Succoth. How far have they gone? Nobody knows for sure where these two places are, but the best guesses are it's about 25 miles. How long will it take 2 million people to go 25 miles? If you realize these were all work-hardened people, and if they walked without rest for 24 hours, they might make it in a day. As they traveled, what would it look like? I told the first hour, I think, here about a guy by the name of John Farmer. John Farmer is a guy who knew the countryside in Virginia really, really well. He worked for Dominion Resources looking for places to put power lines. He said he spent most of his working life outdoors just walking through the countryside, sort of checking out where power lines could go. I went on hikes with him. I would come in with a backpack that had maybe 65 pounds of stuff that I just knew I could not possibly survive out in the wild without. I admit to carrying frozen steaks more than once. Big tents, because I don't like to be too confined. John would show up with this little tiny backpack, a little bit of stuff. And when we started, he'd be out of sight within a matter of minutes. And we'd walk maybe half a mile. And here he was resting up against a tree. The moment we got there, here's John gone again. Now, picture that, right? Here's John, here's us, here's John, here's us, here's John, here's us. What does that look like? One of the commentators said, if you wanted to have something that looked like, it looks like an accordion. Okay? But an accordion who, you know, plays like this. Sort of, yeah. Sort of marching along. the line of march. If you look, we haven't quite gotten to the heart of this yet, but if you look, God actually gives places for each of the groups and says, you move first, you move second, you move third, you go alongside of these, you go behind those. And you have this sense of some of them moving while others rest, others moving while these are resting. And that begins, okay? They left Ramses for Succoth, about 600,000 on the march. Men, that is, not counting their family. It's that phrase, on the march, that I'm drawing your attention to. There's another place somewhat like it where it says they're marching and they have an orderliness to them. How long had they been in Egypt? I'm looking now at verse 40, 41. How long had they been in Egypt? 430 years, almost to the day, in fact, exactly to the day the scripture says, from the day that Israel, that is Jacob, first set foot on Egyptian soil. That was the day the first step, 430 years later, that was the day the first step was taken for the group to leave. Okay? Verse 42, again a reminder of the second purpose of all of this. The night when the Lord kept vigil to bring them out of Egypt must be kept as a vigil in honor of the Lord by all Israelites for all generations. Verses 43 through 51, Moses gives instruction about who can eat the Passover ceremony, the ritual, and who cannot. Chapter 13, there's a couple of interesting pieces here. I don't want to spend too long on it, but I want you to see this much. What has happened to the firstborn of Egypt did not happen to the firstborn of Israel. Read the first couple of verses of chapter 13. What does it tell you? God says, I'm going to make the firstborn of Israel special. Now, what are the words that he uses?
Okay, let me get those words up here. Consecrated.
Mine says sanctified.
Sanctified. Any other? There's one more. My translation says dedicated. To whom?
To
God. Okay?
You get a little bit further down, and in starting at verse 3, down to verse 16, Moses is actually speaking to the people at this point, probably again speaking through the leadership, but it doesn't say that. Okay, and again, he goes back through and rehearses some of the things that we've been talking about the remembrance rituals. But take a look down to verse 11 and 12. When the Lord has brought you into the Canaanites' country, as he swore to your ancestors that he would do. There's that phrase that we talked about. To the Lord you must make over whatever first issues from the womb. Every firstborn cast by animals belonging to you, those males belong to God. But every firstborn donkey you will... Does yours have a verb there? Redeem. With what? With a lamb or a kid. If you don't redeem it, you must break its neck. Donkeys were valuable. Could never have enough of those donkeys. Okay, you could redeem it. How do you redeem it? With the blood of a lamb. The next phrase, all the human firstborn of your own race, all of them, what must you do? You must redeem them. So there's a second phrase here. They must be consecrated, sanctified, dedicated to God. Samuel, later in the Old Testament, Samuel becomes an example of this. But then they must all be redeemed. If it took a lamb to redeem a donkey, what's it going to take to redeem a human? It's going to take a lamb. Later on, that becomes the symbolism that carries you to Jesus. But in the rituals back here, it's going to be a lamb. What if you're poor and you can't afford a lamb? That was the meal back early on. No, for the redemption. Now, you may not know this because we don't really come to this until Numbers and Leviticus. That's where the details start to come out. But a few of you will know it already. The answer is a turtle dove. Okay? When Jesus was 8 days old, his parents took him to the temple. What did they do there? They redeemed him. What does that tell you? He was firstborn. What did they redeem him with? A turtle dove. What does that tell you? they report. Those little signals that are way over there are signals that are being built here. Now, chapter 13, verse 17, who leads the people into the Exodus? Has to be Moses, right? You will look in vain for Moses' name in this little section, except in a sort of secondary role. Who is directing the people? God is directing the people. God is leading them. He's telling them where to go and where not to go. He's telling them how to go. When Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not let them take the road to the Philistine territory. Where's the Philistine territory? The Philistine territory is up here. That would have been the road that they would have taken. It says God did not allow them to take that road, although that was the shortest road to where they were trying to go. Why not? Still in verse 17, it has a quote from God's thoughts in my translation. Does your translation have that? In case the prospect of fighting makes the people change their minds and turn back to Egypt. Instead, God led the people a roundabout way through the desert of the Sea of Reeds. Now, what's the Sea of Reeds? The Sea of Reeds is a big lake. It's a big lake that sits sort of there. And the Suez Canal goes into it or through it or something like that. You do know the Suez Canal wasn't there for all this, right? This is just sort of orienting you, right? The Suez Canal wasn't there. You got that? Okay. In part. The Israelites left Egypt fully armed. Moses took with him the bones of Joseph and tells why. They set out from Succoth and headed to Etham. Where's Etham? Etham is roughly here. Okay. Etham is roughly there. Another 10, 15 miles beyond. Nobody knows for sure, but that's sort of the best guess as to where these things were. All right. Now, verse 21 and 22 says how God has been leading them. This is the first glimpse you get. And this is something very ancient. When Abraham had one of his big encounters with God, you saw this same imagery there. How did God lead them during the day? A pillar of cloud. How did he lead them at night? Pillar of fire. And that leading them at night is the suggestion that maybe they were walking 24 hours a day for the first couple of days. Okay. Was that two different things? A pillar of cloud by day, a pillar of fire by night? Was it two different things? Oh, come on, guys. Probably not. What is required to make cloud? Either condensing water or smoke from a fire, right? During the day, hard to see the fire. You see the smoke. During the night, you see the fire through the smoke. I think it's one thing. It's just a difference of perception of what you see. God is leading them. His leading is constant. The perception of God's leading is changing depending on whether it's day or night. There's a lot theologically you can do with that thought. Some of you who are perceptive can kind of go there. Think about when your life is experiencing sunshine and day and when it's experiencing dark and other things. The perception of God's appearance as he is leading, how he appears to you, how he interacts with you may be different, but it's still the same. Chapter 14, God spoke to Moses and said, tell the Israelites to turn back. Which way is back?
Well, back is sort of that direction.
Tell them to pitch camp, and it's very specific where he wants them to pitch camp. The problem is we don't know for sure where it is. The best ideas of the commentators, the ones that I think have the most credence, that's what I'm going to show to you. I think he took them around to a place that was on the shore of this lake. I think there were big mountains off to the west. I think there was impenetrable desert further to the south. I think there was an uncrossable lake to the east. And now what happens? God says as he said he would. There's a verse I took you to the other day. God does nothing without disclosing it to his servants, the prophets. God says, pitch your camp opposite this place beside the sea, and Pharaoh will think, the Israelites are wandering to and fro. The desert has closed in on them. I will harden Pharaoh's heart. I will make him stubborn. He will set out in pursuit of them, and I will win glory for myself at the expense of Pharaoh and his whole army. And then the Egyptians will know that I am God. And the Israelites obeyed. If you jump down to verse 18, there's almost a repeat of that verse you just read. I will win glory for myself. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. Okay?
So what happens? Here they sit, and here comes Pharaoh and his army coming into the place where they are. Right?
I hate stopping here. We have come to the heart of something. When you look back over at the experience of the Israeli people, the Israelite people, across this time period, there are points of critical moments. One of those was when they listened to Moses, believed, and said, yes, you may lead us, begin to act for us, we will follow you. The second was when that 10th plague came, and they were led out of Egypt. Here comes the third one. Right here. They are in a trap and they have no hope. The next one after that, I think there's some argument how much some others rise to it, but it's when they meet God at the foot of the mountain is, to my mind, sort of the next one of these big points. But this is huge. What's about to happen is huge. And so here's your assignment. Starting at verse 5 of chapter 14 and going through the rest of chapter 14, I want you to look very carefully for four things. Number one, what did Pharaoh do? We already know that. Here he comes with all of his chariots. Okay, probably not his marching army, but the fast moving parts of it. His armored cab, if you will. Number one, what was the people's reaction when they realized Pharaoh's army was coming? Number two, what was Moses' reaction? Number three, what was God's view of the subject? Number four, what happened then? And that's where we're going to have to start next time. So let's have a word of prayer before we go. Now, Father, we thank you for the words we read. And though these things happened thousands of years ago, somehow there's something fresh about them. We remember those verses in the New Testament that say all these things happened as examples to us, as case studies from which we can learn today, because the things that happened are like the things that happened to us. We have our times when we feel trapped, and we have reactions that are human reactions to that. Even the leaders you put with us may have reactions to that. But sometimes they all line up, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes you see something that nobody else sees. Help us see things through your eyes. Help us see our opportunities and our challenges as one and the same thing. Go with us through this week to come. For we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.